We've seen the news stories and we've heard the rumors. Maybe we ourselves have been hurt by a narcissistic church leader. It's easy to throw the term around and diagnose others from afar, but what is narcissism really? And how does it infiltrate the church? That's what we'll talk about on today's episode of the Unhurried Living Podcast. Chuck DeGroat has been counseling pastors with narcissistic personality disorder, as well as those wounded by narcissistic leaders and systems for over 20 years. He knows firsthand the devastation narcissism leaves in its wake and how insidious and painful it is. In When Narcissism Comes to Church, DeGroat takes a close look at narcissism not only in ministry leaders, but also in church systems. He offers compassion and hope for those looking to heal from its systemic effects. He also offers hope for narcissists themselves, not by any shortcut, but by the long, slow road of genuine recovery. Chuck DeGroat is professor of pastoral care and Christian spirituality at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, and senior fellow at Newbegin House of Studies in San Francisco. He served as a pastor at churches in Orlando and San Francisco and founded two church-based counseling centers. He's a licensed therapist, a spiritual director, and the author of Toughest People to Love and Wholeheartedness. I hope you'll enjoy our conversation. I'm glad to have as our guest Chuck DeGroat, author of a new book from InterVarsity Press titled When Narcissism Comes to Church, Healing Your Community from Emotional and Spiritual Abuse. So welcome to the Unhurried Living Podcast, Chuck.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we hit record, I was telling you, I often will tell an author how much I enjoyed reading their book, and that's often true. I won't use the word enjoy, but I did feel the importance, you know. Enjoying narcissism, that might be a problem in itself, but I really appreciated the spirit and the content of what you wrote here.
Yeah, thanks. And I don't know that I can say I enjoyed writing the book. I think it felt like a duty at times more than a delight. But at the same time, it feels important in the moment that we're living in, and probably in all times and in all days, you know, because narcissism is sort of a perennial reality. So you had the same experience reading as I had writing.
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear a little bit about, you know, sort of the genesis of the book, the story of how it came to be.
Yeah. I mean, the shorter genesis is it was a request by some pastoral friends who wanted something that was clear and diagnostic and helpful for the church. They were kind of taking piecemeal from other books about maybe narcissism here, spiritual abuse there. I mean, the harder story to tell is the story of my own narcissism, you know, that goes back to my seminary days when I was in the mid 1990s and I thought I had it all figured out. Yeah. I had my creeds memorized for my ordination exam. And in my story, it was the real grace and honesty of a man in my life who called me out and said, you're arrogant and you're going to be dangerous to the church and you're probably already dangerous in your marriage. I mean, it was a really hard conversation for a cocky 27-year-old. And it began my own journey of waking up to my own stuff and doing a mental health counseling degree in addition to the MDiv and just kind of, you know, this is a lifelong thing. So that's the longer story. You can't write a book on this if you don't know a little bit about it yourself, you know?
Of course. Yeah. I certainly think maybe one of the reasons I had a hard time using the word enjoy to describe the experience of reading it was some of my own reflection and why I've sometimes said one of the reasons I went into ministry was it was a great way to get people to like me and affirm me. And I was so desperate for that and realized that there was some elements of narcissism in my reasons for going into ministry.
Yeah. I mean, who of us, who among us who goes into ministry doesn't quite like being up on the stage saying, you know, thus says the Lord, you know, the word of the Lord.
It's pretty heady stuff.
Pretty heady. Yeah.
Well, so as I read, I loved one of the descriptions you offered to describe what narcissism is. And you said that it's the longing to be free of longing. And I'd love to hear you say more about that.
Yeah, I think in the original context of that quote, it has a lot to do with control. You know, when we live in longing, we live surrendered, and we're able to live. Henry Nouwen, I've been reading Nouwen for years, and one of my favorite books of his is that little book on prayer called With Open Hands.
Oh, yeah.
It's that we live most of our lives with clenched fists, and the invitation is to gradually open up our hands, but that requires us to let go. And I simply don't want to let go. I want to give the appearance of letting go, but yeah, I think the longing to be free from longing, to get back to the quote, is to be free of to be free of this surrender. I mean, it's really about control fundamentally, right? And narcissism is at least in part about controlling and managing and manipulating all the contingencies of life. There's a refusal to live in any kind of insecurity and uncertainty. And I think there's at least a part of that we can all relate to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of the other things you said in the book is you said that narcissism is born in the soil of shame and self-contempt, which sort of, you know, echoes some of what you've just been saying. I'd like to hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in my own story of discovering my own latent narcissism, if you want to call that, back in the day, underneath that was just a ton of shame. I mean, I think it begins at a very early age. And in my work over the years, particularly with pastors, I mean, I was a pastor for a long time, but I've been doing assessments of pastors and church planning and other contexts for years. If you can ever get back to it, and sometimes you can't because there's a lot of resistance, but if you can ever get back to some of the origin story of all of this, there's generally some sort of story of profound pain, bullying, feeling small, unloved, unwanted. And I remember working with a pastor a number of years ago where we got back to that kind of primal story of shame. And I said to him, actually, at one point, I said, sometimes it feels when I'm talking to you like you're like 7 or 8 years old. Oh. What? Tell me about 7 or 8 years old. And you could just tell, like, that right there, just something popped. Wow. And he began to cry, like cathartic tears, right? And I remember the very next week when he came back, he was tough and he was kind of back to his, and he said, I will never go back there again. Do not ever make me go back there again. And it was like it was almost like we were done doing the work at that point, because he had put the defenses up then, and he was recommitting again now as a 45-year-old adult or whatever he was to defending and self-protecting again.
Oh, how tragic. I mean, what could have been, you know, for him had he found his way to the safety of being vulnerable, you know, with a God who calls himself a stronghold, that he could have been okay, but he couldn't see his way to that being a good thing for him.
No.
Oh, well, so in my own thinking, I think I've been tempted sometimes to imagine that, you know, narcissism is like excessive self-love. But you say that actually narcissism is really rooted in a profound lack of healthy self-love. Yeah. I'd love to hear more about that. I think our audience needs to understand that.
Yeah. And I borrow that from someone else. But when I read it the first time, it really struck me as true. The most healthy people were loved well. And, you know, love of God and neighbor is rooted in love of self. And I'm not sure the Old Testament writers, had a deep psychology behind that. But I think at least my understanding of that, it's not a sort of cocky, arrogant self-love. It's the kind of secure self-love that we talk about, especially in the psychological world, that comes from good parenting and good attachment relationships, and a sense that I am secure and I'm known and I'm seen. And I just remember when my daughter Maggie back in the day, I've got daughters now who are 18 and 17, but when she was much younger, she used to do cartwheels and say, "Daddy, Daddy, look at me." And wasn't that great? And now I'd be worried if she was doing that at 50, 40 or 50 years old, right?
Right.
But I do think that that when we're loved as children, we don't need to go grasping after it as adults. And I do think that there's something of, I mean, just as I said the words grasping after it, I can think of that's a pattern in my life. I've grasped after it, you know, and maybe others relate to that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You know, your description of your daughter, that sort of unself-conscious desire to be, you know, affirmed and loved, which is so different than the kind of self-promoting, desperate, you know, attempt to impress everybody and control their responses. That doesn't sound very self-loving.
Yeah. No, and oftentimes we find when we do this work that when we kind of dig down through the layers, those who are diagnosably narcissistic, and I talk about narcissism on a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So there are narcissistic traits that some of us may have, but there's narcissistic disorder, right? Which is further the spectrum. Those who are narcissistically disordered, 9,999 times out of 1,000, were not loved well. And that's a tragedy, you know, and that's why I try to hold in the book some sense of real compassion for those who are even narcissistically disordered, because there is obviously pain in their past.
Mm, yeah. You know, one of the things you talked about in the book, I'm just thinking, you know, I'm thinking of my own experience of church when I first began to describe myself as a follower of Christ 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Small church, relational pastor. He wasn't a celebrity. And then I think of my experience as I look at the landscape of church today. And I think one of the things you said is that in some settings, it almost seems like narcissism is one of the things you want in the gift mix for a, you know, potential church planter or pastor.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Yeah. I mean, that is something that I don't know that I quite understood this back in the day when I started doing church planning assessments, but as I was looking over assessments and qualities of the planter and some of the characteristics that I'd see, I mean, it was almost a recipe for narcissism. You can almost go down the list and match it with the DSM-5 diagnosis. And I think it started to dawn on me, like, we're setting these folks up for failure. You know, we're asking for narcissists. We're setting up churches for pain and disappointment. And so, yeah, I mean, I've heard it said even recently about a narcissistic leader. There was just a leadership style mix that wasn't working. You know, instead of saying no, he was actually a toxic, abusive leader. They just said his leadership style was different.
Oh.
And I think that's a real problem, but I think that that's language that we know and we're familiar with. And I don't blame search committees and church planning assessment teams and seminaries for not knowing these things. I am hoping that we will gain some greater diagnostic categories and have more language to dialogue about these through the book.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about, you know, as we look at maybe particularly, Christian leaders, what are some ways we can recognize someone who's really living in that kind of, you know, like clinical level, like really serious problem level narcissism?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say, just to simplify this, because it could be a complicated answer, you know, but to simplify it, the first thing and the most basic thing I look for is there resistance to dialogue about this? And so let's just say I'm doing an assessment and I get back the Milan Clinical Multiaxial Inventory, which I use as an assessment tool with like 400, 500 questions on it. And it comes back and it spikes right above into the narcissistic disorder area, right?
Okay.
I have to have a tough conversation. I may bring that up in a way that hopefully allows for us to have some conversation. And there could be a range of responses. One response is, I knew it. I knew you psychologists are always looking for the bat. You know, there's that kind of response. Or as there was recently when I was doing one, wow, okay, so that's hard to hear, but I kind of expected that. And this man said to me, I'm not surprised by that. I think that there are some mentors in my life who've seen some narcissistic traits. And my question, I guess, is what do I do? Where do I go from here? And I appreciated that. And then the question for me, the second piece of this is not just is there receptivity, but is there follow through? Because one of the things that I'm finding, and I talk about it in the book, is what I call a kind of vulnerability, F-A-U-X.
Yes.
Vulnerability, where they might say, oh yeah, I'm a sinner. I'm the greatest of sinners. You know, they may even use biblical language like that. My personality and my Enneagram and my wife says this and my, you know, and it might just be a smokescreen that kind of he wants to kind of put me off the path, so to speak, right? So that I don't see what's really going on. And listen, I've been fooled so many times over the years because I believe the best. I want to believe the best about people. So it's tough to see it sometimes.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, some of my own painful experiences in cultural environments, you know, ministry environments that felt a bit narcissistic in mm-hmm. orientation or leaders. And one of the things in my own experiences is a feeling like they kind of create a reality distortion bubble. Like, you know, inside of their world, everything seems to sort of make sense until you just step back a little bit. And then you wonder why you believed what they were saying.
Yeah. And that's the last thing you said. I felt that a lot over that. I wonder why I believe what he was saying, because there is a kind of reality distortion. And I think in the Christian world, they will say things that, and this can be really tricky. Mm. He said things that were just so true. He taught me about the gospel. He taught me about the Bible, and he taught me about Christian marriage. And what do I do with all that now? And the reality is that people who are diagnosably narcissistic can teach truth. I mean, it's not
sure,
but there's a fundamental way of living and a fundamental relational orientation that's always about them, you know. And so ultimately, you're the mirror as the congregant that they're looking into, hoping that they'll get back the affirmation that they long for, you know. Mm. And for you to say to them, "Well, you are a truth teller." Man, that just fires them up. Oh yeah, that's what I long to hear. Yeah.
That's sort of the image they're trying to get at, and now the image is affirmed, and somehow that's enough for the moment or something for them. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you'd mentioned in the book is that dismantling the narcissistic false self, there's a phrase for you, ouch, mm-hmm. Is an act of dying to illusion, to control, to fear. Say more about that.
Well, so it's sometimes tricky to, you know, you're working with psychological categories. And for me also working with the story of God and working with the Paschal mystery of death and resurrection that we all live. There is a kind of a dying that takes place in our lives, a dying to this false self. You know, it seems that in Romans 7, there's a battle going on in Paul. The things I want to do, I don't do. The things I do are not the things I want to do. And there's this question of who am I, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can all kind of relate to this idea that there's this part of me that I'm fighting against sometimes, you know? And I think that there's a dying that happens over the course of years. And I know you're a little older than me, but I'm coming up to 50 this year, and I'm feeling this sense of, man, I thought I'd be over the hump by now. I thought I'd be over ego.
Yeah.
And yet it's not as powerful as it was when I was 45 or 40 or 35. And so there's a slow dying that's happening where maybe it just, it doesn't matter quite as much how the book will do as it did when I was 40, but it still matters.
Yeah.
It still matters if I'm honest, you know,
so of course.
There's that slow dying.
Yeah. And I think that's a helpful way to say it. I think in my youth, I imagined the false self was going to die, you know, like by murder, like I was just going to kill it. Good. Got that done. Whew, let's move on. And it really has felt more like it's just sort of withering, you know, very low, you know, I'm learning how to not feed it. I'm learning how to not reference myself to that voice as me. And, but that's not happening quickly.
Yeah. It reminds me, I don't know if you're familiar with Brennan Manning's book, Abba's Child.
Oh, one of my favorites. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, in that chapter on the imposter, he talks about how his false self is shrinking. And after a while, it's like this little thing that, you know, you can almost set up on, I've got a desk here, set up on the desk and say, oh, you look at you still so worried about book sales, still so worried about approval. But you know, I mean, that was not for me, certainly 25 years ago in seminary, that was not the case at all. It was all false self all the time. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, one of the ways you sort of differentiate some different types of narcissism, you talk about grandiose narcissism, which I think in my head, that's the kind I'm used to or that I recognize. But then you also talk about vulnerable narcissism in the book. So I'd love to hear you talk about how narcissism takes different forms in different people.
Yeah, in the end, I end up talking about 9 faces of narcissism. And this is really, this is something that I think was a combination of some learning early on, but really just doing the work with people and noticing that my caricature of narcissism is the onstage, grandiose, powerful leader. Well, that's not the only caricature. That's not the only picture or face. And that there were these folks who didn't need the big stage, but they were just as manipulative and they used their intellect perhaps, or a kind of emotionality to draw you in, or self-pity. And that's the more vulnerable narcissism. It's a kind of subtle form of narcissism that that kind of comes through the back door. And so a number of years ago, I was working with a woman who was married to a man who would have been that first caricature of narcissism, very grandiose. She ended up divorcing him, marrying another man. She came back to me about 5 years later as her pastor. And she said, I think I'm married to another narcissist. And I said, well, I remember when you met him, he said, he's so humble. He's so almost self-condemning, you know, and she said, yeah, he's all of that. And he's slimy and he's manipulative and he's self-pitying and it's all about him. And he's constantly trying to draw me in to feed his self of sense of being okay. And that was instructive to me. It was yet another picture. And now we have psychological words to put to these things like grandiose and vulnerable, but it's just to say, don't simply look for it in the picture of that polished bully of a politician or celebrity. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think, you know, so your 9 faces, I remember reading that. So, of course, you're sort of referencing the Enneagram and the reality that maybe in our heads we imagine, well, there's maybe 2 or 3, types who, those guys, they could be narcissists, but probably never see a narcissist over here. But really what you're saying, it's a human reality that could take a lot of different shapes.
Yeah. And I was exposed to the Enneagram back in the late 90s. And so that coupled with my clinical work, and I'm starting to see like there's this intellectual version of it and this lawyerly version and this perfectionistic version and this hypervigilant and this really helpful, benevolent version and achieving version. And so I think that it just helps us to have some broader categories so that we can say, yeah, this is how it shows up in my life. And that might look a little bit different than your life too.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if you could just let our listeners know how they could learn more about your work and how to be in touch with you.
Yeah. So a number of years ago, I started a website, which is kind of a blog and some other resources and things like that. And that's at chuckdegroat.net.
Oh, good.
DeGroat is D-E-G-R-O-A-T. So, and that's really probably the best place to get in touch with me. There's some contact info, some of the things that I do, and I've other books that I've written. And so that's probably the easiest place. I teach nowadays. I was a pastor for a while, but nowadays I teach pastors out in Holland, Michigan, right on the shores of Lake Michigan.
Sure.
Little town out here. Still cold. Snowed this morning.
Oh, boy. But, spring, but not spring.
Yeah. They can also find me at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, too.
So, got it. Yeah. Well, again, thank you for writing this book, When Narcissism Comes to Church. And I really appreciate your time, Chuck. This has been a really good conversation.
Thank you.
I wish you could have been there as Chuck and I continued our conversation after we finished our podcast interview. If you'd like early access to extended video recordings of these podcast interviews, you can get that by joining our Unhurried community. Learn more at unhurriedliving.com/community. You'll have access to a curated library of extended video interviews with many of our recent podcast guests, as well as other online courses and resources to help you live unhurried. And we also have a podcast bonus that goes with this episode in particular. It's a sample chapter of the book, When Narcissism Comes to Church. You can sign up for access to this bonus resource on our website at unhurriedliving.com/podcast bonus. Actually, once you've accessed your first download, you'll be granted access to an online resource page that lets you download all of our past bonuses, and it will update with new bonuses as they become available in upcoming episodes. So again, go to unhurriedliving.com/podcast bonus. As always, we love connecting with more and more friends like you who want to rest deeper, live fuller, and lead better.